For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week there's a factual flavour to the show. Political commentator Eche Temelkaran discusses her new book, Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now. Best-selling author Mark Sullivan reimagines an extraordinary true story from the Second World War in his new historical novel, The Last Green Valley. And I explore a political biography and the Glasgow shipyards with narrator David Monteith. That's all coming up in today's Read On. But first, the Philip Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest and most prestigious award for children's literature. Past winners include many of the best-known and most-loved children's authors of the last 9 decades. And, as regular listeners to Read On will know, competition this year was particularly stiff. However, there could only be one winner, and the announcement was made at an online ceremony on Wednesday. And the winner of the 2021 Philip Carnegie Medal is Jason Reynolds for Look Both Ways. Jason, many congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So for the one or two people who might not yet have picked up Look Both Ways, could you give us a very quick overview?
Sure. Look Both Ways is a collection of stories that makes one whole story about a bunch of kids who go to the same school and the independent and individual journeys that they all take on their different walks home.
They might all attend the same school, but they've got very different backgrounds and home lives. And part of the title, Look Both Ways, is not just telling them to watch out for themselves, but also to see things from different points of view.
Right. You know, it's interesting, right? Because I think young people sit next to each other every day. I think teachers sort of look in their classrooms and they see all these kids who are side by side and sharing lunch tables and sharing food and sharing lockers. But the truth is that every kid has a very separate journey. And that in order for us to really appreciate the beauty of our children, we have to understand that each of them actually, as much as they are the same, they are different. And if we can teach them this, that like to look both ways, to say that there are many different perspectives, there are many different lives, there are many different lives within each and every one of you, then I think we get a better grasp, a truer grasp on the world.
And we certainly get that in those 15 unsupervised minutes where children are just themselves. They're not conforming to any teacher or parent's view of what they should be.
Exactly, right? Like when we think of, especially when it comes to children's stories, we think of school or we think of home. But the truth is, there is a liminal space, right? There's actually this strange sort of buffering space of freedom where there are no adults, where you're just on a journey, you're on an adventure. And that's where you really discover who you are. That's where you discover the world you actually live in. That's where you discover who your friends are, what your fears are, what your dreams are, right? Like that particular 15-minute window where the sort of down-pressing hand of adults or the watchful eye of neighbors really aren't there to sort of guide you or get in the way of your childlike expression.
The judges cited their reason for choosing the book because it is an innocent tale that covers hard-hitting issues, including bullying, homophobia, and bereavement, which are not always things that are covered in children's books, but are actually part of everyday life for an awful lot of kids.
Absolutely. And my job isn't to teach them or give them any answers. My job is simply to present them with questions. You know, imagine a world where we teach young people to wrestle with the world around them. We teach them to wrestle with right and wrong, right? Instead of this binary, interesting, bifurcated way that's oftentimes reductive when it comes to our everyday lives. What if we actually presented information and we framed it in a way that was meant for them, and then we allowed them the space to wrestle with it so that I don't have to say, here is the right answer. Instead, I say, here is the situation. Now you wrestle. Right. You tap into your empathy here. I've set up guideposts, but I don't want to give it all away because that's not actually my job. My job is to bear witness to your lives and to respect you enough to allow you to do a little bit of that work on your own.
And I know that you're the U.S. ambassador for children's literacy. And we've discussed before, you were a late reader yourself. But actually, you really do provide a role model for any children who might be hesitant about their own literacy, about expressing their own thoughts, because it hasn't come easy to you, and it didn't come the normal way of maybe studying books at school. For you, it came through music.
For me, it came through music, absolutely. I mean, I was a young person who, it's not that I didn't want to read or that I couldn't read, it's that I didn't think reading was for me. I didn't think I had a place in it because I'd never seen my face in it. It's that simple, right? And so because of that, I gravitated toward music. Rap music was big in my time, and as I was coming up, that was the phenomenon. It still is, obviously, a global phenomenon, but when I was growing up, it was a new phenomenon, and I loved it. I didn't want to be a rapper, though. I wanted to just read the lyrics. That's what introduced me to poetry, and from there, I realized that language had power.
It's second time lucky for you with the Philip Carnegie Medal. You were shortlisted for Long Way Down in 2019. What does winning this particular literary award mean to you?
It means a lot of things. You know, I think ultimately the Carnegie is a big deal for me because it lets me know that, like, perhaps, just maybe, I've written some universal stories, right? And it lets me know that young people gravitate toward this. But I have to be honest with you. There was a chip on my shoulder. And this award also means something else for me. Sometimes, as an American writer who's so grateful to be published over there. But, you know, there were some hard times in the beginning of that process because people would always say that my stories were too American, right? Like that was a thing. But I've traveled the world with these stories, and I know that young people from every culture, every background, from all over the world, laugh at the same jokes. That there are these intersections and these connections that they all understand. That there's a youth culture that actually transcends any actual nationality. And I've been arguing this for a very long time. And so what does the Carnegie mean for me? More than anything, it means that actually my stories aren't American stories. They're human stories. They're about young people. They're not too American. And this proves that they're not too American because y'all chose it as the winner.
And certainly that universality is caught in the subject matter, because any child who is fortunate enough to be able to go to school has that 15-minute walk home. One thing that is unique to the Carnegie Medal winner is that you get a copy of your book in Braille. Have you got plans for that?
You know what? I'm going to put it in my archive. The reason why that's important to me, though, is because I actually am the grandson of a blind man, and he is no longer alive. I wish he were here so that he could read with both ways now that it's going to be in Braille, you know. But I grew up with a blind man, and so I'm very familiar with sight loss and with blindness and with Braille and with sort of just being in community with people who cannot see. And so this is actually really emotional for me to know that that is a part of this victory, is that book in Braille. It means the world to me. And it's also bittersweet because my grandfather was my father's father. And so what I would do is give this book to my father, but unfortunately he's no longer alive either. And so I'll keep it for myself and tuck it away.
Well, Jason Reynolds, Philip Carnegie Medal winning author of Look Both Ways, many congratulations on your success, and I look forward to inviting you back onto the show in years to come with stories to come.
I appreciate it, and good to talk to you.
Look Both Ways by Jason Reynolds is available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. The last time Ece Temelkaran appeared on the show, it was to discuss her book How to Lose a Country: The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. In it, she urged us to combat a rising tide of populism. 2 years on, in a world that appears more divided than ever, she's back with a new book. But in Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now, she isn't conducting a post-mortem, as she told me when she joined me from her home in Zagreb.
Ece, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you, Red. Thank you for having me.
The new book isn't about how we've messed things up. It's far more about the choices that we can make for a better world.
That's true. It is not a revolutionary cookbook, or it's not a political self-help book. But yeah, I would say it is about the choices that we are supposed to make in 21st century to be more humane and to be able to build a better world.
At its core is a plea to have faith in our fellow human beings.
Exactly. Because after How to Lose a Country, after I've written that and after I gave speeches all around the world, wherever the book was published, I noticed that people have lost faith in humankind in general. We are going times of several crises, one thing. And like every system has this magical ability to make people that if it collapses, all collapses with it. We are in that phase now. This is one thing. And also there's the pandemic. There's this enormous inequality and several other things. So I think in this era, when the system collapses, we have witnessed several strong men, so to speak, appearing here and there, popping up in several places in the world. They're authoritarian leaders, and with them, an ignorant mass has been mobilized. So due to this fact, we have been represented by the worst of our kind constantly. On social media, in politics, in social life, on several levels. I think because of this, we started losing our faith in humankind. We started asking the question, is human evil in his or her essence? And this is a very dangerous question, and I noticed this all around the world, especially in those countries where populism is on the rise. So I wanted to ask and answer that question, why do we believe in humankind, or how can we believe in humankind again? That is the main question behind the book.
In the book, you talk a lot about dignity and how we need to choose dignity over pride, which is what the nationalists and populists are urging us to do. Could you just explore dignity a little bit more for the listeners, please?
Well, I mean, look, I noticed this again after I wrote How to Lose a Country. There had been two masses mobilizing almost at the same time around the world. One mass was the mass of authoritarian leaders. They were asking for greatness. They were asking for their pride back. Whereas the other mass, which we saw on Tahrir, in Occupy movements, in Black Lives Matter recently, they were asking for dignity. And I noticed that there's a big difference, although these two words sound quite close to each other. Pride is about oppression and power and oppressing the other in order to prove your supremacy. Whereas dignity is a word that accommodates oneness of humankind. Because when one is subjected to indignity, no one can be dignified anymore. I think the oneness, the human love in the word dignity, makes it completely opposite of pride, especially in today's global politics. So, yeah, this is the other central concept in the book besides faith, dignity, because I do think that this is the word that we are going to be talking about in this century. And whatever the new political movements be, they're going to be talking about this word more and more, because dignity is a word that can cut across the class differences, several other differences, identity differences, and so on. So maybe all our outrage and all our protest, all our reaction to the current system and the injustices will gather around the word dignity. I am hoping this and also kind of observing it as well.
Yeah, I got a real sense that you feel that dignity is a unifying word, whereas pride is something that is exclusive to others, and that dignity is also something that we can choose, whereas pride seems to be something chosen for us.
Absolutely. And if you are talking about getting your pride back, you don't have to change the system. Within the system, you can oppress the other to have more pride. Whereas if you want human dignity in this world, you have to change the entire system. So dignity is a revolutionary word, whereas pride is a backward word that also accommodates the seeds of new kind of fascism in our world today.
I was also very interested by your examination of how we have bought into a lie that if the status quo does disappear, there will be this chasm of chaos, whereas actually what we need to realize is throughout history, when bad things have happened, human beings have always managed to adapt to their new surroundings.
Absolutely. They did not only adapt, that they also became better as well. in several cases. And actually, we do not even look at history to prove that this apocalyptic view of humankind is not true. Look at what we have been through, pandemic. If this pandemic was a Hollywood movie, we would be eating each other. There would be cannibals and so on. Mm-hmm. But opposite of this happened, and we actually started thinking about what we can do for each other. And also, we started thinking about our survival as well. So this understanding of humankind, which became very dominant after 1980s, the social Darwinist perspective of humankind, which actually legitimized the system, the economic and cultural and political system that we are living in, proved to be wrong in this era, in this last year even. Instead of becoming social Darwinists, we produced a lot of Kropotkins from ourselves. Kropotkin is a Russian writer who wrote about mutual aid among the species. He believed in Darwinism, but he criticized social Darwinism. And he thought that the species are not always fighting for life. They actually, you know, helping each other out as well. So this is something that I want to make people understand. Human beings are good. Because if you start thinking and believing that human beings are good, then you can have a reason to act. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth doing anything for humankind. And that kind of cynicism, I think, is quite common among people.
Yes, and you draw the parallel between social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest, and also how that is the capitalist message, that it's acquire more, and that people forget that if you're accumulating more, it's usually at the expense of others.
Yeah, the motto, there's no alternative, that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan voiced in the 1980s, became our understanding of the world, because we started thinking that imagining end of the world is actually easier than imagining the end of the system, which is a tragedy for humankind, because it means that the humankind does not believe in itself anymore so that he or she can imagine a better future, a better system.
And that creates a polarization of views. It's either do this or there will be catastrophe. If we don't have capitalism, then we can only have chaos. And actually, it's more nuanced than that. And I felt the most fascinating chapter in the book was choose enough rather than less, that rather than either having more or less, there is a middle ground, and that is enough.
Yeah, I mean, like, the economy of less is something very interesting, and everybody should be reading a lot about that, because it's one of the most important views in sustainability and, you know, new economics and so on. But also, we might have to think about enough. What is enough? Because less does not really cover the complexities of today's economy, I think. On the other hand, to know what is less or what is enough or what is excess, we have to understand economy. Because I think after 1980s, less and less of us progressives were interested in economy. We were kind of pushed away and we were put in the corner of cultural criticism. It was like a sandpit. Play here your cultural criticism. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, we're going to run the world with all these numbers. I think the most important responsibility for a progressive person today is to understand economy. Because in order to do better, we have to understand the system. We have to really decode the system. And we have to be really better in this. And then we can understand what is enough, not only in our personal lives, but in the most complex global economic system as well.
You argue that the global economic system of capitalism has preferred just to give us its toys to play with in the sandpit and leave the money matters to the bankers, which obviously has had some fairly catastrophic results. And yet you do give us a lot of hope in this book and show that the models of mutual aid have come out through the reaction to the pandemic and other disasters around the world. Particularly, you point to the COVID mutual aid groups that have sprung up in the last few months.
There's this motto, see the big picture, see the big picture. Yesterday, I was talking to Nesrina Malik, and she said, maybe we should look at the little, the small picture, because that small scale pictures give a lot of real information about humankind. Seeing the Sicilians doing this mutual aid basket thing, they're filling each other's baskets and so on. Or, you know, seeing other mutual aid programs in London, in several other countries, in Istanbul, in Turkey as well. That is reality as well. And there is not only an optimistic view of the humankind, or it is not a minority. It is the majority, I think. That's why we still survive. You see, I mean, like, if we were really evil, we couldn't have survived as humankind, because evil is not sustainable. The good is sustainable. So that is why we survive, because, you know, determination of creating beauty is inherent in us. And this beauty can be political, can be in social life, in everything. So, yeah, we created beauty despite the fact that we were going through the most boring catastrophe.
At the beginning of the book, you do point out that beauty is very fragile, but what you do is to assemble fragments of beauty and humanity and trust and friendship that you have seen throughout your life, and especially during lockdown, to produce, I thought of it rather as a stained glass window. You call it a talisman of faith, for us to remember that humanity is greater than this perceived threat of catastrophe.
Absolutely. Yes, this is what I wanted to do. And I love the stained glass metaphor. Yeah, we talked about How to Lose a Country on this program again. And you read this book as well. I think I have this way of knitting stories to each other, like small stories and then big stories, micro picture with macro picture and so on. So I am trying to zoom in and zoom out from humans. I want to look at the essence of the humankind, and then I want to go up, 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 zoom out, and then look at the big crowds, masses, and so on. So, yeah, I think Together is a book about the politics of emotions, because we are living in an age of emotions. And if emotions are the topic of politics, which I think they are, we have to be discussing them as well. And among these things, of course, you know, one of the most dangerous topics to discuss is faith, because it has a habit of getting out of hand. But still, I think progressive politics should be discussing more and more about these seemingly fragile or dangerous or naive words, because actually the world goes around with these words.
But how do we separate faith from the morality of the rather patriarchal religions that have taken hold of it for the last 3,000 years?
Well, I am not the first and certainly the not the only person who thought about faith in the secular perspective. And I'm talking about faith in humankind. I think we might want to admit that we are the ones who invented faith, and the need for faith is stronger than the faith itself. And also, we might want to understand why we need the God as the mediator of our human love. I do think that we forgive God much more than we forgive our fellow humans. And there's a good side of faith. You don't have to prove it. Because when you say hope, they ask you back, like, you know, so prove us. But when I say, oh, I believe in people and I believe in you, I don't have to prove it.
One of the starting points of that, and another chapter heading, is to choose friendship. Because friendship is where we do recognize our common humanity with other people, but it's also something we have to work at.
Friendship, if you ask me, is the place where there is absolute justice. That's why I really wanted to take friendship as a political model. How can we think of friendship as a political organizational tool, so to speak? But, you know, I came to this friendship, of course, through Spinoza and several other thinkers, but also through my own experience in Turkey, especially with Kurdish people. It is, in its essence, about choosing each other. Do we choose each other? And making a moral choice of being in friendship with humankind can change a lot in our political life as well.
And the same attention that we bring to friendship is something you also argue that we should bring to our dealings with headlines and social media. Rather than getting angry about things that irk us, we should look at them more in the whole.
Anger is an issue that I have been thinking about a lot because of my personal situation, because of the world, because there's this new generation of women who are not afraid of being angry. But we have to admit that we are living in an age of survival as a planet, as a global community, as humankind. And, you know, we are in this verge of collapse of a system and several other things are happening. So we are actually in survival mode. And when you're in the survival mode, anger might be time-consuming and energy-consuming. So we need a more sustainable political emotion to base our political action upon. That is why I propose to replace anger with attention. I am not the first one who talk about this, because before me was Iris Murdoch, Simone Weil, and ironically enough, several other female thinkers. Talked about attention, because it is important when you're a woman as well, you have to know how to handle anger and so on. So yeah, and I do think that the most effective political action today comes not from anger, but from attention. And my best example for this is Greta Thunberg. She was never angry, or she never excessively expressed anger like many other people. She just paid attention, and she declared that her attention is determined. And she called people of the world, to pay attention to what's happening. And that's how she mobilized the entire global community. I think that is something that we have to take as an example, because we're living in an age where anger is commodified in our social media, in our communication sphere. So anger cannot be any more a revolutionary emotion.
Yes, you point out, as you say, anger is commodified. Social media is predicated on upping the ante, and attention is a good way of diffusing that. And if anger is directed towards us, as doubtless it will be if the kind of movement that you are encouraging does start posing an alternative to the populist politicians, then you also instruct us not to fear fear, because fear actually is what makes humans pull together.
Yeah, I am proposing to befriend fear. One, because we're living in the age of fears. And second, rejecting the fears cancels out our humility. Because during the times of fear, we now know that as a reflex almost, the attitude towards mutual aid is dominant. We can still survive and we can still help each other.
This is what we're told is happening to us now. The economic and political system that we have built has reached its limits, and while it begins to fall, it threatens to drag us down with it. Any choice we make seems as ineffective as a bucket bailing water from a filling hull. The enormity of the chaos deceives us into believing that whatever we do is too small. And finally, we tend to forget that our kind is in fact able to reinvent itself through even the smallest of things.
Daphne Alexander narrating Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now, written by my guest Ece Temelkaran.
You narrated How to Lose a Country yourself. Why did you choose, Daphne, to narrate this book?
Good question. Not everybody like my Marianne Faithful / I don't know, Bob Geldof voice. And I wanted someone without an accent, because I want nothing to get in the way between the reader and the book.
And she does a splendid job. I think she sounds like your English cousin.
I would love that. Yeah, I need an English cousin to read my book. So thank you. And I'm so thankful to Daphne for doing this amazing job.
it is a wonderful manifesto for creating a new social contract in the world. And it's full of anecdotes and observations from your very eventful life. One lovely nugget that I took out of this is that your surname actually means foundation builder. And I can only have faith that this wonderful book together is going to build the foundation for us all to stand together for a better future.
Thank you so much. This was really wonderful to hear that, yeah, my surname, we have meanings to our names and surnames. And I am a foundation builder. Hopefully I can build one.
Ece Tomulkaran, thank you so much for coming on to the show to discuss together. And I look forward to seeing you next time you come to Britain.
Thank you, Red.
Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now joins How to Lose a Country in the RNIB Talking Books Library. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, David Monteith looks back on some of the highlights of his long career as an RNIB Talking Books narrator. But first, here's Robert Kirkwood.
Mark Sullivan is the acclaimed author of more than 20 novels, including the number one New York Times best-selling Private series, which he writes with James Patterson. His new historical novel, The Last Green Valley, looks at the true story of one family's incredible story of daring, survival and triumph, and the impossible decisions they must make involving the Soviet invasion and the Nazis. It's based on the untold true story of the Martels, a Ukrainian family who fled Europe during Stalin and Hitler's terrorising reigns and began a long, arduous migration west to freedom in Montana. To research the book, Mark Sullivan relived this long trek, trailing the Martels' route through present-day Moldova, Romania, Hungary, the Czech Republic and Poland, and along with surviving children Bill and Walter Martel, who are now both in their 80s, travelled to Ukraine, where they visited for the first time the ruins of their childhood home they fled with their parents. The audio version of the book is narrated by Will Damron.
A cold wind blew in the dawn light. Bombs echoed from the north and east. The rumble of war was getting closer by the minute. 28-year-old Adelina Martel struggled out the back door of her kitchen in heavy winter clothes, carrying a crate full of cooking utensils toward a covered wagon harnessed to two dray horses in front of her modest home in the remote, tiny farming village of Friedenstahl. A damaged German Panzer tank clanked and rattled past her in the early morning light, upsetting the horses. Trucks filled with wounded German soldiers streamed after the tank. Adelina could hear their cries and tortured sufferings long after they'd passed, and she could see more trucks and more horse and mule-drawn wagons like hers coming from the east, silhouetted with the rising sun at their backs.
It's the story of a young family of refugees, mom, dad, two little boys, in a horse-drawn covered wagon, trying to outrun the Soviet Red Army while under the protection of the Nazi SS.
And it's based on a true story.
It is. It's based on the true story of the Martel family. They were ethnic Ukrainians whose ancestors had lived in Ukraine for well over 100 years. And they lived in these agricultural colonies. Life was good until the communist takeover. They were thrown off their lands. Their parents were sent to the gulag. They were treated horribly, starved. The Germans come and invade in 1941, and they give them back their land, and life's pretty good for about 2 years, other than what they see the Germans doing in the early Holocaust. So right at the beginning of the book, as Stalin is counterattacking, they have a decision to make. Are they going to stay and wait for the Soviet bear, or are they going to run with the wolves, the Nazis they've come to despise? There's no good decision. They go with the Nazis, and what happens on this trek, the actual historical event, the long trek, they're caught in times between the two armies. They're in tank battles, bombardments. They're trying to flee west, and their whole idea is that at some point they're going to leave the Germans and run for the Western Allied lines. and freedom. This is what they dream of. They talk about it as this beautiful green valley where they can live in peace and prosperity. That dream alone and love and family gets them through one of the more incredible ordeals I've ever heard of.
Now, you talk about the long trek. This is a trek that you actually did in research for the book.
Yes, I did. I retraced the entire journey that they went on, starting in going to Ukraine with two of the survivors, the little boys, actually, who are now men in their 80s. And we went to Ukraine and found their ruins of their farmhouse. We went to the site of a prison camp where their father was imprisoned, and he finally escaped from and somehow miraculously found his way back to them and their mother. It was an amazing experience to retrace it and think that they did it all in this wagon or on foot.
Did they have memories of that house?
Oh, very much so. When we confronted that, when we found the ruins, you know, it was just remarkable to watch these two old men seeing the incredible arc of their life going from the ruins that they're looking at all the way to Montana and this incredible life that they built for themselves.
As a former journalist with this book and the previous one, Beneath a Scarlet Sky, is there a temptation just to write a straight non-fiction book, or is the novelist in you always coming out?
There is a temptation to do it, but the thing I'm trying to do is not give you a read about factual events. I want you to go on the trip. I want you to have the experience of sitting on Emile Martel's shoulder or Adeline's shoulder and understand exactly what they went through. This is a book that you'll never forget just because of that approach, the novel approach of bringing it to life.
And the audio version of this book's read by Will Damrod, as is Beneath a Scarlet Sky. Did you have any influence on the narrator?
Yes, I did. Beneath a Scarlet Sky, there were about seven that auditioned, and I thought he was great. He was a fluent Italian speaker as well as English. And he was so good that we decided that he would do an awesome job on Last Green Valley, and he really has. He's remarkable.
Is there not something you're ever tempted to do yourself?
Right now, I'm undergoing a series of mouth operations, so I tend to slur, so no, not this time.
Now, sorry to keep grouping these two books together, but Beneath a Scarlet Sky and The Last Green Valley were quite a departure for you. Was that a deliberate thing to get away from the thriller writing?
No, I found Beneath a Scarlet Sky on the worst day of my life, as is described in that book, and I went to Italy to interview Pino Lella, and the three-week experience literally changed my life, and I basically had to become a different kind of writer. I had to add all sorts of techniques and tactics to my arsenal of storytelling in order to tell a piece of historical fiction based on a true story. The first one took me 10 years in my spare time. I was writing other books, but Beneath took me a decade. This Last Green Valley took me about 2.5 years to write and then a year till publication. So I'm getting quicker at it now that I can focus 100% on it.
Now, you said you went to Italy and you did the long trek. Do you find going to the locations is no excuse for looking them up on Google Maps?
Oh, Google Maps are great. And there are times where I literally go back to the places I've been just to remind myself of what it looked like, you know. But there's no substitute, as far as I'm concerned, for being there, because it makes room for serendipity. You never know who you're going to run into or meet. In this trip, I met this guy who was 98 years old, and he was one of the last survivors of Stalingrad. And he was remarkable. He was hale, he was healthy, he was a beekeeper. He ended up becoming part of the book, and I never expected it.
It doesn't shy away from the very dark side of the journey. Did you find it hard to write that sort of deep despair?
Terrible, because you have to get inside their heads. And I know that they were in deep despair many times, and I had to consistently understand where they were physically, emotionally, spiritually during the entire ordeal. And it was. Some of the stuff was horrible. My wife could describe it to you. I would come in pale from writing it.
And what do you hope readers will take away from the book?
I hope they take away two things. One is that freedom is something that should be cherished. There are people all over the world who would literally die trying to get to it. And the second thing is that there are no limits to the human spirit, that stories like the Martels remind us that remarkable brutal, almost unfathomable challenges can be endured and overcome and triumphed over, and the Martells are proof.
She watched another tank go by, took a step closer to him, and said quietly, "You're sure, Emil? Running with the Nazis like this?" Emil responded in a whisper, "We can stay and wait for the bear that we know will kill us, or rape you and kill me and the boys, or imprison us all in Siberia. Or we can run with the wolves that will protect us until we can make our escape west. Escape the war. Escape everything."
Mark Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Mark Sullivan. And Mark will be back with Robert at the end of the show to share the books of his life. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Mark Sullivan to hear the books of his life, one of the great joys of working at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden is that I get to meet some of my favourite narrators in person. And hopefully, with life slowly returning to normal, I'll be back there again soon. In the meantime, let's rewind a couple of years to the day that I interviewed Glasgow-born David Monteith. As you'll hear, he was narrating a book about the man the current Labour leader is named after, although this interview was recorded when his predecessor was still in charge. So, which book was David narrating for us?
A biography of Keir Hardie.
Any good?
It's very good. It's very interesting. It's always fascinating to read about the history and the founding of the Labour Party, where it came from, a lot about the founding principles and about the man himself.
He had quite a hard life, didn't he?
He did. He was a miner. He was born to a very poor family. I think he was the eldest of five or six, and I'm going back 3 days now, and I can't always remember what I read on Friday. But certainly one of possibly two of his siblings died when very young. So he was part of a very large family. He recounts a story about being sacked when he worked for Bakers, very wealthy Bakers. And because his father was away looking for work, his father was a ship's carpenter, his mother was ill, and so young Keir was the only breadwinner. Because he was working so hard, the weather was dreadful, he turned up 15 minutes late for work. He was told by the girl he was working for, under the auspices of this much richer baker, that if he was late again, he would be in serious trouble. Unfortunately, the next day he was also 15 minutes late. This was the second day he was late, was his payday. He turned up at work, hoping that everything would be well, was instructed to go and visit the senior employer, the very wealthy man who was sitting at this massive breakfast table with his entire family assembled. Young Keir was soaked to the skin, barefoot, basically the archetypal, stereotypical urchin. He was told that he had brought the bakery into disrepute and that people to whom he was supposed to be delivering were going to leave the bakery because they weren't getting their morning rolls when still hot. So he was sacked. Not only was he sacked, he was fined the previous week's wages. So lost his job, was sent home to an ill mother with nothing but the girl who had chastised him the day before gave him a single roll. He knew of what he spoke when he was founding the Labour Party.
The social injustice.
Absolutely.
And he worked in the mines as well for a bit.
He did. Again, it's jumping quite a lot back in the story. Mm. I've gone beyond there, but I think he was in the mines for about 15 years.
Gosh, a hard life as well, but one that led him to become a union representative and led to his political career.
Absolutely. And interestingly, for somebody who was born in Scotland and lived a lot of his life in Scotland, he was an MP in England and in Wales, but never in Scotland.
Oh, how funny. I never realised that. I wonder what he would have thought of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Keir Hardie was the man who suggested state socialism at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, indeed. I suspect he would have seen eye to eye with Mr. Corbyn on many things. He said, treading in the middle ground.
Well, maybe not appearing at Glastonbury, but...
Well, Keir Hardie certainly appeared at many conferences and events and meetings. I guess part of what he would say is any way you can get the message out and across to people is worthwhile.
Absolutely. I was looking down the list of talking books that you've narrated for the RNIB library, and you're quite a one for taking the renegade characters, aren't you? Especially the Scots.
Well, I'm Scots, and that's where I'm from, that's where my accent naturally lends itself to, and that's the nature of the books I'm offered.
Did you enjoy reading, I think it was Renegade by Robin Young, the Robert the Bruce book?
I did. Obviously, that was based on fact. There was a lot of interesting story woven around that to tie lots of things together. But yeah, it's a great book. Massively difficult in one respect, in that before one of the huge battles, there were a huge number. There were, from memory, I think it was about 30 young Scottish noblemen, all talking to each other, all discussing the battle, which, from the voiceover point of view, made the vocal transition from one character to another, working out who was speaking when it didn't necessarily say, you know, said John, said Robert, said Dugald. Made it very complicated, but it was a fantastic read. Great story.
How do you go about preparing that? Do you have coloured markers or...?
Yes, I normally read from an iPad, and there's a piece of software called iAnnotate. So I'm usually set, not so much with R&IB books, they tend to be paper. But for commercial books, they are almost always PDF format. I get them and I very simply read the book and then read it again, highlighting dialogue and working out a colour coding for each character so that I know when I do a quick glance down the page that the hero is about to turn up. So it's just, it allows me a couple of seconds just to be aware that I'm going to have to do a vocal change.
So in some ways, not only are you the complete cast of actors, but you are also the director as well.
In many respects, yes, because I'm making the decision about how a line comes out. Sometimes it's not necessarily a conscious decision, it just presents itself. You happen to say something with a particular emphasis that you may not even have considered when you were reading it.
And what led you to the R&IB in the first place?
I was offered a book. It was that simple. I spent years as a, I still am, a commercial voiceover. I do an awful lot of work on film and television. One of the commercial publishers approached me about doing a book. I happened to end up doing it here. Would I be interested in reading for R&IB? And I said, absolutely, yes, of course.
Quite a lot of tartan noir.
Yes, I do an awful lot of Scottish crime.
You don't strike me as a particularly threatening man, but do you have a rasping burr to your voice, which you
There
say?
Is a certain pitch I can get to, if I really need to.
I'm scared now.
he lied through his teeth.
I recognise that from, I think you did an Inspector Rebus, a question
yes,
of blood.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so that's your chilling voice.
Well, it's one of them. It's like being a musician. You have certain tunes that you can fall back on that you know are going to be popular, and sometimes you have to just use them to allow the story to roll on, and you get to do maybe slightly more adventurous stuff with incidental characters. It can be vocally very tiring to do too rough and deep and gravelly a voice for an entire book. So my Scots heroes tend to have, as I do, light Glasgow accent, slightly heavier than the one that I normally speak with, because my voice is narrator voice, and then you have what I think of as hero voice or anti-hero voice, which is the one that I go to most easily, the one that I can get to at any point.
I also noticed that you have rather a nice hero in The Nicest Viking.
That was an absolute joy. They were great. I love reading kids' books. I used to read to my own kids before they got to an age where they went, Dad, stop reading to us. It's boring.
A book that you read that is very real and that I enjoyed dipping in and out of because it was a world I knew nothing about was Song to the Clyde, a history of shipbuilding on the Clyde.
That was quite a personal one. Obviously, growing up in Glasgow, I was very aware of the river, but my grandfather was a naval architect. He designed submarines in the 1930s. So when I saw it sitting on the shelf, I said to Rupert, if when you were considering casting that, you might consider me, I would be eternally grateful.
Oh, it's a wonderful collection of stories and anecdotes and insights into... Well, a world that's gone. I mean, not only are the ships' names forgotten, but so are the names of the people who worked there.
Indeed. And the number of shipyards. I mean, I remember about four names growing up in Glasgow in the 60s and 70s. There were, I mean, obviously more than that. There were yards that weren't the huge commercial yards that we think of today. My grandfather worked in Yarrow's, there were John Brown's, there were, you know, a few others dotted about the Clyde. But from the book, I learnt about the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of shipyards that there had been, and not just on the Clyde, which, you know, obviously the main river going through Glasgow, but on all the tributary rivers and even the canals, there were bona fide, proper shipyards making narrowboats or canal boats or structures that were then transported down those canals to the big major yards. So it's a fascinating process.
And do you often find yourself really engaged with the books that you read?
I think you have to be, because you're trying to express the story, and it's, you always have to remember that it is, generally speaking, it is a story rather than a biography. As the narrator or the reader, you have to be committed to the point of view or the course of action that any character you're reading about is going through at that time. Be that something, you know, wonderful, a celebration or a massive love story or whatever, you have to buy into that with the same degree of enthusiasm as you have to buy into being the murderer in a rebus.
For a full list of the dozens of books that David has narrated for RNIB, visit the rnib.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Mark Sullivan for the books of his life.
Mark, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
First books I ever really got into were called the Freddy the Pig Mysteries. They took place in a barnyard on the Bean family farm. And when I was a little kid, my mom taught me to read when I was 4. I started reading those when I was 5, and I was obsessed by them. And it's probably why earlier in my career, I wrote mystery and suspense novels.
And I believe it was a teacher that made you write as a punishment.
That was. I got in a fist fight in parochial school, and my punishment was to write a short story, go figure. And I was in second grade. It was grades 1 through 8. And by some miracle, I won because I wrote an article, a short story about a rabbit getting chased all around a farm by a beagle.
Charles flew up and perched on the edge of Hank's manger. "Touch of winter," he exclaimed. "I guess there is. It's cold, that's what it is. Downright cold." "Well, we've got to expect it now," said Hank. "Snow will be flying in another month or two." "Ugh," said Charles, and shivered. "There's less work for me in winter," said Hank, "though I must say I prefer the summer. I've got a touch of rheumatism in my off hind leg, and these cold nights set it aching." "Of course," said Charles sympathetically. "They would. It's a shame. You ought to have a blanket or something to cover you, and this barn is a terribly drafty old place. But Mr. Bean, he never thinks how the animals and birds suffer. He sleeps warm under his feather bed and 4 patchwork quilts. He doesn't care as long as he's warm. Now take me. Every morning, winter and summer, I have to get up before daylight, crawl out of my comfortable coop, and crow and get things started on the farm just because he's too stingy to buy himself an alarm clock. Doesn't matter how cold and rainy it is, it has to be done. And if I miss a morning, what do I get? I get fricasseed, that's what."
John McDonough, reading the first of the 23-volume Freddy series, Freddy Goes to Florida, which are available commercially. Now, is there a book on a rainy day that you go back to again and again to reread?
Yeah, the most impressive book I've read in the past decade, and I've read it twice, is called Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. It's the story of a guy who escapes certain imprisonment in New Zealand, and he gets off a boat in Mumbai and becomes part of the Mumbai Mafia. It's an extraordinary book.
Working for Abdel Kader Khan was my first real instruction in organized crime. Until then, I'd been no more than a desperate man, doing stupid, cowardly things to feed a stupid, cowardly heroin habit. And then a desperate exile, earning small commissions on random deals. Although they were crimes that I had committed, and some of them were very serious, I was never really a criminal until I accepted Gadabai as my teacher. I'd been a man who committed crimes up to then, rather than a criminal, and there's a difference between the two. The difference, as with most things in life, lay in the motive and the means. Being tortured in Arthur Road Prison had given me the motive to cross the line. Another man, a smarter man than I was, might have run away from Bombay as soon as he was freed from the prison. I didn't. I couldn't. I wanted to know who had put me in there and why. I wanted revenge. The safest and fastest way to that vengeance was to join Gadabai's branch of the Mafia.
Our old friend Steve Hodson narrating Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. And please be aware that it's an epic 48 hours and 8 minutes. An equally epic commercial version is also available, narrated by Humphrey Bower. Is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
I just read my oldest son's first novel that is going to be published in July. It is called The Sleeping Bear by Connor Sullivan, and its premise is based on the true fact that every year in the state of Alaska, somewhere between 2,100 and 2,400 people vanish without a trace.
The audio version of Sleeping Bear by Connor Sullivan will be narrated by Hilary Huber and released along with the print version of the book in July. Mark Sullivan, thank you once again.
I appreciate your time, sir.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL. And Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.